Right. I apologize a little for my voice. One of the great things working for a newspaper is you get to work with a lot of people that go to exciting countries on a regular basis, and then they come back with these exciting new variants of flu and give them to you. So I might end up doing part of this as mime. We'll see how we go. Right. So we basically work as the interactive team at The Guardian, and we spend most of our time sort of producing new ways of doing data viz. But this is not new stuff. And I'm guessing, I mean, how many people here have produced a chart as part of their job at some point? Okay, so most of you. I mean, like most of us now, if you're not working for an agency, you're working with clients that have a lot of data. And if you're working for a mid to large organization, you're basically awash with tons of data. So what we're seeing more and more is these organizations have data science teams. So they'll have, you know, stats specialists who will put together this stuff, and they will, you know, find some insights and some things that hopefully empirically will allow the company to be more efficient. But what often we see, because I sort of do consulting work as well, is that when it comes to communicating that stuff to the larger organization, it falls flat on its face, because there isn't the expertise in how to actually effectively communicate things about data. And the role of visualization is to effectively communicate stories around data and to turn that into actionable information. So, I work for The Guardian. We're quite a forward-looking media organization. We've got can better access our content via API. There's all sorts of stuff in the data store. We do a lot of work with crowdsourcing, and we try and basically take advantage of technology to find new ways of telling the news. So you might know us for headlines such as this one. So I work as part of the interactive team at The Guardian. So we're quite a small multidisciplinary team. We're kind of an experiment that's been set up. So we consist of designers, journalists, and developers. We work very, very closely together on projects. We look like that when we're not at work. And our job is to basically take data-heavy stories and try and turn them into something that normal people can understand. So this is a pretty good example in some ways. This is actually, when the Murdoch story broke, this is something we put together. So basically this was pulling all the tweets and then taking out the joining words and looking at the common words that were coming out to try and get a sense of sentiment without sort of relying on Twitter sentiment analysis, which tends to be a bit weird. And so basically you've got like frequency over the top and then you've got most common words there. And so you kind of get this sense that it's quite dull for quite a while and then it sort of skips along a bit and people get very, very bored and somewhere in there start making up sort of modified Jay-Z quotes. But then, in a second, it all kicks off. And this isn't telling people something they didn't already know, but what it does do is actually surface something that we all know is there, but we can't actually see the, so basically that's the Jay-Z stuff. People got really, really bored at that point. But it allows people to see something they know is there, but they've never actually been able to visualize before. And that's the really exciting stuff about this work, is that ability to surface things. But we don't just do sort of fancy Twitter stuff, so that was when he got hit with a pie and it just all went completely nuts, which is good fun. But so we also do quite a lot of sort of heavier data analysis. So this was a piece we did recently looking at USAID contracts, doing analysis around corporate ownership of aid. We also sort of do like random 8-bit games and all sorts of fun stuff like that. But we exist at sort of like the absolute pain point in terms of technology, because about 20% of our users are i7 and 8. We're trying to do fun animated graphics and we're trying to do it with web standards. So we hit pretty much every problem that you can in this area. And we work with a really great graphics team, and they produce sort of fun things like this. And as much as I can, I sit with them because they've got like 100 years experience putting together really, really cool charts. And you bring that experience to bear, and you realize how much bad stuff is out there. So I mean, like, it wouldn't be a Viz presentation if I didn't have a god-awful example of something from Fox News. Not so good on the stats there. But there's a lot of sort of subtler stuff that can kick in, and my slides appear to be in slightly the wrong order, which is mildly concerning. What's happened here? Apologies for a second. Right, something's gone horribly wrong there, so I'm going to skip very slightly forward. So this is a really basic chart, right? Really, really simple. It's about as simple as they come. So you're a web developer, you think, okay, we can implement that fairly quickly, right? But then you start, if you're a good developer, you're going to start wanting to generalize this kind of content. So you only want to write this chart once, right? And this is where it starts going horribly wrong, because then you start realizing how many design decisions actually come into an incredibly simple chart for it to be effective. So you look at the Y scale. So you've got what units they are, you've got where those numbers sit. Do they sit to the left of the tick, to the right of the tick, under the tick, above the tick? Do the lines continue all the way out? And then how you do these things affects the rest of it. So basically, if you want those numbers to be out beyond the tick, then that changes the scale at the bottom. Do you want those numbers to be under the line, under, or do you want them in the middle? Are they intimating that's the year or the start of the year? You get the colorization, the thickness of those lines. Do you have the individual points on the line, or do you just show the line itself? Do you put the labels over there? Do you want a separate box? Do you want to put the titles in there? Do you want, actually, look at the far right of this chart, and you'll see the data actually goes off the top of the chart as well, and that's a very specific design decision. And what that graphics team do is basically make these hundreds of decisions every day. But if you're a developer and you try and generalize something that can handle all of this, it starts getting really weird really quickly. And you look around the web, and there are hundreds of charting libraries, literally hundreds of the damn things. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. I mean, the biggest one is that it's easier to write code than it is to read it a lot of the time. So people think, ah, oh, this is easy, I'll write another one, and they release it. But there is kind of another thing going on in that you take another example. And so you've got, and so now you're coloring your labels, you've got these at an angle, it gets more and more complex. You take another example. Now you've got standard deviation kicking in here. So basically now you're not just visualizing the number, but you're visualizing an area around the number itself. And if you're a developer, you start thinking about the number of configuration parameters you're going to need to be able to do this stuff, and it starts getting pretty scary pretty quickly. Go even further and further again. So this is a really good example. So what you're actually doing here is you're basically showing an area for each line. You've got time series starting at different points. They're finishing at different points. You need to support positive and negative scale, different units, a different sense of time. Now you've got a hell of a lot of configuration options. And it's not just us that hit these problems. I mean, here's a really simple example from 538, the New York Times. So now you see those lines are continuing off the bottom, but they're not actually showing anything on that axis. And then you look at the units on the scale on the right, they're not showing the number at the top. Gaps in between are now 4%, and it's, and you take, compare it to that one, suddenly you've got no lines on this axis, you change the axis, you've now got two different levels of lines, and it's all these configuration details make it incredibly hard to actually create a single reusable charting library. So you do this for any period of time, and you think, well, sod this, we're going to start using low-level libraries to do this stuff, because trying to create one reusable component to do it just doesn't work. So for mapping, the one that we really love is Modest Maps. And Modest Maps is an interesting library because it's actually got this incredibly long lineage. So it's now a JavaScript library. It's worked on by Development Seed, who own Mapbox, and Stamen, who you probably know for their beautiful sort of watercolor mapping tiles and things like that. These guys know what they're doing. But this library used to be Flash. And before this library was Flash, it was Java. And because of that, there's this incredible intellectual lineage in terms of the way it's constructed, because they've had to solve these problems many, many times before. And that means that it's a very small library, it's a very simple library in terms of the actual total gamut of functionality. But the stuff it does incredibly well. So, I mean, where are we? Let's see if we can get this up for a second. Can I get a mouse? And because it's so well written and so small, it means you can do really, really nice stuff like this, and it just works beautifully quickly. Except for the fact that I don't have an internet connection at the moment. But the smoothness of that animation comes from the fact that the internals of the library are so well written. So going back to presentation for a second. And then for all the other charting, D3 is the library we use. And D3 is wonderful because it's so simple in terms of the fact that basically what you do is you just map data to DOM nodes, and then you use that data to effectively set the properties of that DOM node. So imagine you've got 10 points of data. So you've just got individual numbers, and then you've got 10 divs, and you set the width of those divs against that number, and bingo, you've got a bar chart. But it actually provides this additional functionality, which means you can pretty much create any kind of chart, and the far extremes of this stuff are just incredible now. I mean, this is basically adaptive cutting of geo projection, and the ability to do that in SVG and basically reuse this code instantly is what makes D3 wonderful, because you could then turn this into like a choropleth, so like colorize each country versus a piece of data really, really quickly. And it works, yeah, it's just the things that are available there, because incredibly smart people are working on this thing all the time. It is wonderful from my perspective. But the problem with D3, well, it's not really a problem, but it's more of an attribute of the way it's created, is that you look at D3 code, so this is like putting together a basic bar chart in D3. And you look at it for a second, it starts looking like jQuery code. I mean, you've got lots of chaining involved, you basically work in elements, you apply things, and you then get the element back, so you can then continue down. So you're setting a bunch of styles at the top, you've got some event handlers here, and that puts together your code. But much like jQuery, you start building larger applications, and you run into a problem, because you need a structure. So if you've been doing this for any period of time, you reach for your standard MVC frameworks. But there's a few problems specific to this space that aren't actually addressed particularly well by traditional MVC, because it was never really designed for doing UIs. And there's a lot of research into the best way of building UIs, which hasn't really translated that much to JavaScript yet. So I mean, you look at histories of things like Java Swing, WPF, any of the frameworks that were for building desktop applications, and they use very different sort of constructs to actually build applications. So we've been working on something called MISA, which is sort of a set of basically libraries designed to address some of this stuff. So this is in conjunction with Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, confusingly enough. So I'm being paid by Bill Gates to write open source, not an expected development. And we're working with Boku, who you might know because they underwrite sort of Grunt and a bunch of other open source libraries, and Irene Ross there, who actually worked on IBM Many on this. So to give you an idea of the kind of problems we're trying to solve, so imagine you're trying to create something like this. So this is GitHub's internal charting of response times. So you've basically got an aggregate here, and you've got the individual breakdowns. You've got the average of something. You might want to know the 90th percentile, the 10th percentile of that, and you want to show all the individual data as well. And that means a traditional sort of model and collection approach doesn't work particularly well because you want to work on your data in totality. You want to be able to run operations against an entire set of data, not just individual points. So we wrote a library called MISO Dataset. And what this is designed to do is to work with any kind of tabular data. So you can pull in stuff from CSV files, TSV files, JSON files, REST APIs, anywhere you can get this stuff from, and then operate on it as collections. So to give you a practical example, so this is basically using Dataset to pull down all the GitHub issues for a particular repo. Really simple three lines of code. So then what you do is you can then take that and then expand that out. So this is a bit more of a complex example. So we pull down those issues. And then what we can actually do is just extract a view, which will give you just the open issues. You can then take that, pull out the assignee name, do a group by operation on that, and before you know it, you can count how many issues are against each person. And it ends up with a very small amount of code. And the nice thing about this as well is you can keep pulling that data and it'll real-time update all the way through. So you could basically build a chart of just the open issues, and then every time those open issues change because you pull in new data, that chart can be dynamically updated because there's a venting all the way through this system. So it gives you that ability to do this. I'm going to very quickly do something. Sorry about this. I've realized what's actually happened here. Can I possibly go over to that one? No, I can't. Sorry about this. Shit. Trying to operate in a monitor that far away is not that easy. Right, I think I'm just going to keep going. Fuck it. So the next big part is basically reusable charting. So what we're trying to do is create a way that we can actually create pieces of charting we can reuse primarily based on D3 without actually losing the ability to customize them on the fly, because that's the thing we need the most. So basically, it's creating a situation where we waste as little code as possible when we create these things, but we still have the ability to customize them as we go along. So if you want to basically instantiate a simple pie chart, it's as simple as that, right? And that gives you a nice basic pie chart. But imagine then you want your pie chart to look a bit different. So imagine you want your pie chart to look like that. So it gives you the ability to provide a styling object. And the styling seems like an odd thing to put in JavaScript rather than CSS, but a lot of the styling involved in charts actually maps very poorly onto charting because it doesn't really map to the properties of CSS. You end up either abusing those properties or writing something a little bit different. So basically, you pass in a style object, you pass in some different colors, you set the inner radius to zero, and suddenly you have the chart you want. But imagine you want to go a little bit further. You want some additional functionality. This is a quick example looking at I'm really sorry about this. The ability to basically highlight sections of the chart and have them grow when you mouse over them. So you've got two additional pieces of functionality you want there. One of those is the ability to have the segments grow when you mouse over them. The other is have the segment highlight in color. And each one of those is a separate thing. You might want one, you might want the other, or you might want both of them. So what we allow you to do is basically define mixins, which if you come from like a Ruby or a Python background, you'd be familiar with the idea. It's basically a piece of optional functionality that you can then mix into your chart. And they become really easy to pass in like that. And then the third ability you may well want is the ability to completely customize a chart the same way you would extend a backbone view or anything like that. And that's it looks a little bit like that. And there's a few other issues specific to this problem area that we're dealing with as well. So imagine you're looking at something like this, a small multiples. So you've got a whole ton of charts that are related to each other. So basically, if you advance the month in one of these charts, you're going to want all of them to advance. But then if you want to then turn off the event bindings for one of those charts, if you're doing it with a traditional binding framework, you're going to have a problem because they work on identification by a callback. And if you've got lots of identical objects, they've all got the same callbacks. You can't identify the individual callbacks. So it's implementing things like a token-based system. So you do a subscription, you get a token back, it's unique to that subscription. You can then unsubscribe based on that token. But the third level of this is probably the most interesting in some ways, is a scene structure. So this is kind of, well, if you're a software developer, you'll think of it as a finite state machine, but it's one with high support for asynchronicity. If you come from like a more of an editorial background, you think of it as a way of mapping a storyboard quite neatly into code. So you imagine you start with a piece like this, and then if something happens and you end up looking at that, it takes you a while to understand what on the earth has actually happened there. What you actually want is a nice transition between them, because that's what communicates most effectively what's actually happened to the user. And I think there's still, in the JavaScript community, a belief that this kind of animation is unnecessary, but in actuality with DataViz, it's a core part of how you explain to the user what's happening. Because you've got a mental model of the data, you're trying to communicate that mental model to the user. Anything that helps you do that is key. And animation is a really, really important part of that. So we're trying to support that kind of asynchronicity. And basically make it very easy to define your scenes in such a way that you can have asynchronous translations between them, but not have to worry about each level of asynchronicity beyond the individual level. Right, so that's actually the end of my slides. What's happened here is I've loaded up the wrong version of a presentation, because I redid it when I got on stage, which is why it's all a bit rough. Apologies for that. Any questions?
Okay. It's a good thing that all of that is being on video, because we can play it back in like a third of the time or something, and then we see what we've been talking about.
Yeah.
We have 40 minutes of Q&A. just saying. But I challenge anybody of you here to actually say the word asynchronicity as fast as he did. It's a bit like reading CSS specs and trying to pronounce specificity. Which is not fun. But talking about fun, so we had a few good questions, which you can actually now take your time to answer, like 5 minutes for each or so.
That'd be okay.
The main question was that people had, like, that Vitaly has, because he's a big fan, obviously, of it, that there are still a lot of Flash visualizations online. Mm-hmm. And do you see a need where Flash would still be necessary?
Very little. Very, very little now. I think that's changed a lot in the last couple of years. I mean, I think the biggest problem now, I think the reason you're still seeing so much, particularly with news websites, is you've got graphics teams that have an authoring environment in Flash that just doesn't exist in HTML. So you've got people that are very au fait with that. They have no idea how to create it with HTML, and there's no GUI tools that really replicate the same environment, and I think that's the biggest problem at this point.
I think Adobe are working on some of them. Actually, exporters from Flash to other standards. Which brings us to another question that people had. My God, people, stop tweeting. You inspired them. That's interesting. What do you do about IE less than 9? Is a VML fallback a good idea?
Yeah. We've used Raphael a lot to do that. So basically, we'll do all the actual execution logic in D3. And then the actual rendering will fall back to Raphael, for example. There's actually a really neat library called R2D3, which is an attempt to actually do that abstraction purely inside D3. That works fairly well. It's also, if it's anything geo-based, there's a library called Leaflet, which is really good for mapping, which has VML support for any vector internally. So there's a lot of different things you can do to address that. I mean, we, at this point, still have to support IE7, which is incredibly painful. And it does mean that, you know, we lose a third of our development time on that. And increasingly, it's becoming a business issue, because it's such a percentage of time. You think, well, we could get an extra project done out of every three. But it's definitely an issue. But basically, Raphael for Vector is the short answer.
So how does it work on mobile devices? Because you do, with Miso, you do a lot of JavaScript calculations and sorting and things, and that can be incredibly slow on mobiles, especially like older mobiles.
Yeah.
Is there a fallback to a REST API? Is there an idea to do that?
That's actually a much bigger problem in a way, because I mean, I think the biggest thing with a lot of the interactive content is it just doesn't make sense on mobiles. I mean, most of the formats, just they're a silly thing to load in a mobile device, because they're just not going to be readable, or people can't interact with them because it's just too small. And actually, this is actually another problem with sort of the responsive design stuff, because it deals with refactoring an existing layout or design. But what you actually need with interactive content is a fundamentally different format. And so with us, increasingly, it's you'll author things two or three times from scratch. And it's kind of conceptually the same piece of content, but in practice, you redo the entire execution of the front end. And then we'll just do a detect and basically pass you to the right thing. Hmm. So it's a much deeper problem, really, than it is with normal content.
Did you find that you reach the limits with Miso at times? Do you find that your visualizations can become laggy if you do a lot of sorting and
Definitely.
And testing?
Definitely.
What can you do about it?
A little beyond a certain point. I mean, I think it's about being realistic about the capabilities of the devices. I mean, we end up actually, particularly with anything for mobile, actually doing very specific detects for even different versions of iOS to try and get a sense of performance, because there'll be things that'll run very nicely on iPad 2, but not on iPad 1.
Breathe.
And it is that level of detail, particularly around performance. So like SVG performance would be fantastic in some browsers, but terrible in others. And it also changes version to version. I mean, you can get issues where particular versions, I think the current version of Chrome 22 actually was really degraded performance of modest mouse transitions for some reason. But if you run it against beta, it's fine. And that can be the difference between a project working or not, and particularly when you've got editorial stakeholders to please and they're running certain versions on their machines. If it doesn't run nicely in that, then you've got a really big problem. So,
yeah. Would just a static graphic fallback be an option? I mean, I think using something like Phantom.js or like running a server in JavaScript that does an image generation of a static version of that just for mobiles?
Yeah. It really does depend on the content. I mean, in some situations, I'd argue it's better to fall back to a table of data.
Yeah.
It really does come down to the specific use case. But I think a lot of the time, it's actually asking whether it makes sense to do a mobile version at all, or whether actually this is an experience that only makes sense to do on a tablet or a desktop service.
Do you see any reuse in print of what you're doing?
Increasingly, actually. The biggest thing tends to be projects with a lot of geographic data, because it's just so hard to do by hand. But the nice thing about SVG is because it's all vector, you can do that very easily. And it's something that I think with the pressure on newsrooms, it's increasingly something they're keen to do.
So what were the slides that you didn't show?
About half of them.
Anything you want to cover that you haven't?
I had a terrifyingly confusing time because my slides were sort of half right but half wrong, and I couldn't work out what was going on for a while. That was interesting.
Nice. I was impressed that you tried to debug on a screen far away from you like
that. That was
it's amazing. I mean, I train speakers at the moment. I do a lot of speaking myself, and it's incredible how many times you're on two screens and you try to move the mouse to a screen on the left of you while your mouse is going to the right. You will fail immensely. Yeah. So this was impressive.
Can I ask you about that training at some point?
It's okay. It's like everybody's scared, and it's good.
I think the biggest things we didn't cover is probably going into a bit more around the reusability of the block stuff. I mean, that's hopefully what we're planning on doing with that is, I mean, if you look at what's happening with web components, that's kind of very much going in that direction. So what we're trying to do is almost set up a bit of a straw man for the meantime. It's kind of, can we create a way of doing this before that standard exists?
There is a system called Xtags, actually supported by and written by Mozilla, that actually allows web components in IE9 and upwards.
Oh, right. Okay.
And we're using a few bar charting things in there, just to plug that a bit. But web components, and I'm sure Alex and other people will talk about this, is a very interesting part, because a lot of this interactivity that we have right now could be semantically defined in the document as well, not written with JavaScript.
Yeah, ideally. Yeah. But then it comes down to the issue of the amount of configuration required to get the desired effect.
Yeah.
And that does tend to be the challenge.
There was a good question. How is it to work with journalists and designers? Like, what are the tips that you found working? Because a lot of them just give you a PowerPoint or something and say like, okay, this is how it should work, and now make it animated and make it pretty. And as soon as you animate it, it's not pretty.
Yeah. I think the biggest thing is fast iteration. Usually we'll talk to journalists and they'll kind of have a sense in their head of what they want, but they're very poor about communicating that. But until you actually put something in front of them almost as a straw man, just kind of say, well, is this not what you want? You don't really get good feedback. But as soon as you start doing that, you get a nice tight iteration loop, and that's by far the best approach. I mean, in terms of working with designers, I think the closer the better. If you can sit next to each other, that's ideal. I mean, I think the reason our team works so well is you've got all three elements literally sitting next to each other. And that means that we can turn around things like that write rooms of peace in a week.
So how does the data get in? Right now it seems to be just data sets, but I've seen other talks, and I tried to remember who it was Dan Mills actually at some conference, and he talked about that he actually wrote a content management system for the data viz for designers and journalists so they can actually reuse them. Do you do something like that?
We use a variety of things, to be honest with you. We built some tools that allow journalists to effectively create JSON. We use Google Spreadsheets quite a lot, simply because it provides a really nice UI. We haven't actually used in production. We've experimented quite a lot with CrossFilter as well, which is by the same guy as D3, my boss doc. And that's really good when you've got huge amounts of data. I mean, that's built for a very specific use case, but it's great for that. In terms of sort of UIs, beyond that, not really. I mean, like at the top end, we've got people that know how to write SQL and use R. So they can give us a CSV and that works fine. But below that, it tends to be basically Google Spreadsheets, just because it's a familiar UI for people.
And it comes with a form automatically.
Yeah.
That's the interesting bit.
There. Actually, the other thing to mention would be the Panda Project, which was being run by the Chicago Tribune. So that was a Knight-backed project to basically create an interface for journalists on top of big sets of tabular data, make it really easy to search. So if like a name comes up, you can quickly look up police records and things like that. We actually started working with that as a way of creating a UI, creating a back end for DataViz as well. Hmm. Oh, and there's a project called Data Wrapper, which is being run, well, Gregor Aish, driven by Data on Twitter, who does really good visualization work, is heavily involved in that. And that's basically, you upload a set of data, actually uses me as a data set to do the upload, and then you can configure and you get a basic chart out the far side, and that's a really good project.
Do you have a repository on GitHub where you actually put the data viz afterwards and what you've done or the tools that you're using? Because, I mean, we heard about it, but it was far too fast. You're doing a great job at The Guardian. I mean, not many people know this. When you see a data viz like that on The Guardian, normally the data set is available in Google Docs as well for you to play with. And that's, again, I hadn't seen any other newspaper that does that, so it would be interesting to see your tooling a bit more as well.
Yeah. I mean, there's one project which we're actually planning on doing that, which isn't public yet, which will be the first one we release the raw data plus all the intermediary steps and the scripts involved. The biggest issue actually with releasing all the toolset is we use Google Refine quite a lot, which is now becoming Open Refine, but that doesn't by default give you an audit trail.
So it's kind of Google Refine?
So Google Refine is a platform for sort of taking quite big chunks of data and then doing operations to do things like entity resolution. So imagine you get 10,000 contracts through, and you might find 7 different spellings of PricewaterhouseCoopers. It sort of has a bunch of algorithms built in that make it very easy to then identify all those and resolve that down. So that's a really common sort of data problem that we face. But that doesn't give you an audit trail. So you can kind of say, well, here's the file that went in, here's the file that went out, but we can't actually explain what happened in between. So we're trying to find a way of actually being able to give people a full workflow of how we got from A to B with data. Mm-hmm. And that's a bit of a challenge.
Talking of data, I used to work with the UK government when they released their open data platform as well, which then got canned when the other party got voted in. And a lot of this data is incredibly dirty. Is there actually an automated process to clean it, or is there some artificial intelligence stuff going on, or do you just churn numbers by numbers?
The closest is Google Refine, but a lot of it is by hand. It can be incredibly time-consuming. We've had situations where we get like a team of 5 or 6 interns to work on something for a couple of weeks to go through, because there's just no other way of doing it. A lot of it is domain-specific as well, so it's not just like anyone can pick up this data and understand what's going on, unless you understand the context around the data, and this is often the thing that isn't released. You can't really do anything with it anyway. So we often, before we work with something, we have to sit down with the right government department and actually quiz them about what the hell the data is, and then find out that half it isn't there, or they've forgotten to record something or release something, and it's a complete mess.
What was the most interesting thing that you found just by making a visualization before actually looking at the data?
Actually, the U.S. contract stuff, looking at U.S. aid contracts, it was the level of concentration of major agricultural firms was much higher than anticipated. I mean, there is kind of 2 stages in terms of like our workflow that we use visualization. The first is actually that exploratory phase, and you just throw it up and you see what pops out. And we're actually doing some work with European patent data at the moment as well, and that's another thing where you occasionally just find a category that you just never would have expected that many patents to be in, or they'll all happen at a certain time, and you can kind of chart the rise and fall of areas of industry, essentially, through that data. So that's been really interesting to pull apart.
Is there on the other side of things, did you have a chart where you actually found some information, showed it, and it turned out to be completely wrong, and it had to be changed quickly?
I don't think that's ever happened. We basically have quite a careful process before we put things out. We have had situations where we spent weeks working with a data set to find there's just nothing very interesting. That's more common, and that's a really hard problem because you can't tell before you've done the work.
The transition systems that you showed, that the animation between two can tell the story much better than anything else. You talked about that you had lashback from JavaScript developers saying like that's not necessary. What did that look like?
I don't think it's so much pushback, but I think it's just a sense in the community that there isn't traditionally much of value. It's kind of seen as like flashy, shiny bits rather than a key part of the experience. So I think it's more of a sense of where the value is seen in terms of animation. That is slowly changing. There's a really nice JavaScript animation library. It's under a little bit of a funny license called GreenSock, and that allows you to do much more sophisticated tweening. I mean, this is one of those things that I think was very common in Flash and derided in the JavaScript community as a result, where because it was a keyframe-based system, it had such good support for doing all sorts of tweening of animations and then reversing them, doing all that kind of stuff, people did overuse it. But it is an incredibly powerful technique for explaining a set of data.
Did you find accessibility issues with that?
Oh God, yeah, it's a nightmare. creating an accessible version of a lot of this content is really, really hard. I mean, a lot of the times, I mean, I've got a couple of friends that are blind, and I kind of sit down with them, and screen readers make a mess of this stuff. And often the best thing you can do is basically provide a link to the raw data, because there isn't really an easy way of providing even a summary sometimes. And text is often a far better format than any kind of interactive or even raw data. So,
how about progressive enhancement? I mean, what I've done in the past is leave the data table in the page for a screen reader to actually index and just generate on top of it. Is that feasible, or is it just for very, very simple charts?
For simple charts. I mean, I think you get beyond a certain point of complexity, it doesn't really work. I mean, you think about something like the Riot Rumors piece or the Twitter piece, the sheer amount of data under there is going to be completely meaningless to display on its own. So it's kind of, there's a point at which that technique kind of caps out.
So when you work on data visualization and things like that, do you just go through the web and look at other newspapers and go like, oh my God, I know exactly what they're trying to do here? Or do you see some things that are just, do you also dive into the source code of other people's stuff to see what they've done?
Oh God, yeah. I mean, it's quite a close-knit community. So we know the guys at the New York Times, the Texas Tribune, the LA Tribune, and we'll catch up with them. We'll talk through techniques and how they're approaching certain problems. And yeah, that's a very common thing. We'll pull apart each other's work and try and understand what they're doing. And it tends to, people riff off each other's work as well. That's really common. So we do a lot of stuff with sort of like animated balls, basically. And now you see the New York Times doing a lot of stuff with animated balls. And then they did a really nice technique of like judging like public sentiment on two axes. And NPR did a really nice piece that's kind of taking that technique a bit further. So I think we're all trying to work out the best way of creating this stuff simultaneously, so we all kind of work quite closely.
So question, and obviously I think you can't answer it. Can we expect more open source stuff from The Guardian?
I think, yeah. I mean, there's been certainly a support for it from management. We're keen to push more and more of our stuff in public. I know the rest of the development team is as well. And I think the biggest issue is just we're trying to do so much simultaneously at the moment. It's getting it to that point where it's that thing where things are good enough for production but not good enough for GitHub. So it's finding the time to actually get things ready, that it's not just like throwing them out and just leaving it there.
So you're finding a lot that you work just getting it out of the door rather than able to plan it through it? And
oh, no, I mean, we work on incredibly short timelines. I mean, like, these projects will be quite big things, but we'll turn them around in 2 or 3 weeks. So it tends to be very, very fast. And once they're done, they're done. And it is quite a different to, like, if you work on one tool for a few years, you know, you can iterate that code base and tidy it up and all the rest of it. But with this, you know, it's you knock it out. If it's a day late, it's probably worthless. So you've really got to hit that deadline, and that often means you just hack things until they work. So you see some horrible code behind me sometimes, partly because you just have this pressure in terms of deadlines.
How about code reuse? Do you actually reuse a lot of stuff you've done before, or do you? What is your process? You say like, okay, here's the infographic that we have. We have a live Twitter sentiment analysis. We went it through a database. We want a bubble interface. You've done it once before. Are you going to look at the old one, or what is your process to go from like the spec to what you need to get on the screen? In very slow words, because we have 15 minutes to cover.
We do reuse some things. I mean, what we're trying to do with the Mesoblock stuff is actually dramatically increase that reuse, because it is a problem, particularly around sort of more basic components. Actually, there's one more thing I might try and throw up.
Yeah, go for it. Yeah, show a movie, do whatever.
See if this works better than last time, right. Can't be worse. Right.
Get a Mac. Oh, wait.
Right, so if I do that, then let's see if I can... Hey, there we go. Right.
Nice.
Oh, bloody hell.
Language, young friend, language.
Right now. Oh, look, it's another deck. It's slightly better. It's got a lot more slides in it. It's like it was designed for a longer talk or something. Right, so the point I'm trying to get to, so, yay, that's an animated pie chart. So that's what it should have looked like. So that's what I was talking about in terms of reusable but optional pieces of functionality. You've kind of got highlight there, and you've got mouse overs, and they're both things that you might want in one situation but not in the other.
But that the thing came out of D3, isn't it? It's one of the components that is already in the box there.
Yeah, well, partly. But this is basically, so this is a piece that it isn't actually public yet. I think it's going out today. But this is the first thing we built entirely with reusable blocks. So the map itself here is a reusable block, that slideshow is, and it's using scene to actually do the overall structure. So basically you've got the walkthrough is sort of like a series of defined scenes that then have entry and exit points, and they then handle the transitions. So you've got a data set behind this that updates a global state, but you've got all these extra pieces that we can now reuse very, very quickly in other pieces. So you'll see in a minute we've got like a, there's a nice little piece here which basically visualizes shape files, so you can see the change in the layout of the city over time. That's reusing the same timeline component, which is being used by the main piece. You'll see that in a minute. And it's getting to the point where we get that high degree of reuse. And there's, you know, there's lots of frameworks for reusable components, but there's some of the problems that are specific to sort of visualizations. This is another one, sort of like this nice little slider back and forth effect that we use lots of times, and it's trying to get these things so we can reuse them a lot faster, so we can do these things it's closer to deadlines. But you've got this underlying data set that pulls this whole thing together, and it sort of, it means the whole thing's a much more integrated package, basically.
Wow. This is beautiful. I mean.
So, but this was actually put together in a week and a half.
Wow.
So that's the kind of like, that's the deadline system we run to, and that's why we need the code reuse, because there isn't time to write things from scratch a lot of the time. So that's that's what we're trying to achieve.
So you code like you speak, really fast.
yeah, that's where it comes from. So this would have been a good presentation, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it's not bad. Do you see that? I mean, this a half a year ago probably would have been a 6,000, 7,000 pound project for a graphical design studio to make a video like that.
Yeah.
And can you think that that marketing materials could be created out of interactive graphing systems like that?
I think increasingly they are. I mean, the big case is like annual reports. Should I sit down again?
If you want to, unless you want to show more.
I think the big use case here is annual reports. So, I mean, they used to be a big cash cow for graphic design agencies. Every year they get this big budget to put together a big, shiny, sort of nicely printed report. But I think the big thing now is companies want custom analytics dashboards. They want nice little iPad apps with graphs on them for their C-level executives to understand what's going on. I think that's a massive growth area. From talking to friends in agency, they're doing more and more of that kind of work. So I think it's those situations where you need things to look beautiful, be entirely customizable, but they don't want to be writing those charts from scratch every time, that hopefully this stuff will be really useful to them.
So, yeah, talking about interfaces and talking about iPads and things, can you think that in the future or near future, actually, there will be there will be charts that actually make much more sense with touch than with anything else? Do you think that interactivity of systems could be an interesting point for data visualization in the future? I'm thinking Kinect, these kind of things.
Oh, God, yeah. Kinect's a harder one, just because it sort of gets into that Minority Report territory of lots of swishy things that look cool in movies but are very hard to actually make useful in real life. But certainly interactivity between multiple charts and that ability to play with things, I think, is huge. Play is a really big thing. So, I mean, one problem I've seen with analytics systems where they'll be pulling like data across a big corporation, and they'll have a couple of hundred properties across all this data, and they want their analysts to try and understand what's going on with this. And so they want to create these interfaces that encourage their analysts to play with that data, to just throw things together and see what happens. And it's quite an interesting challenge to try and encourage people to do that. But it is almost like using like a Microsoft Surface or something, so they can just like throw things in and see how they go and see if there's a relationship. So yeah, definitely. And the touch stuff is really good fun.
Yeah, which brings me to a UX or again usability, accessibility issue. How do you sometimes make people understand what is interactive and how to use it? There's a lot of different interaction patterns in there. Do you find that like that some of your visualizations need hinting, and what would you do with that?
Well, there's two parts. I mean, one thing you might have noticed with that the video of that piece was that when you exited the sort of the guided mode, there was basically a box just saying you are now exiting the guided mode, have a play, try things out. And you, I think particularly when you're dealing with a general audience, you need those kind of hints. I mean, I think a lot of the Flash pieces we produce still have almost like a page that'll come up and say, you can move this piece around, and you can do that. And you still need that to a degree. I mean, the other part is walking people through data. So, I mean, this was almost like this piece is almost a two-part presentation, because you have that area at the start where you've got lots of text, and it tells you a story, and it steps you through it. And then you have that free explore. And that's an idea called the martini glass, where you have that very narrow path for a while, and then you let people explore. But the other purpose of having that narrow part is that it trains people as to what they're looking at. So by the time they start playing with it, they have a concept of what they're actually looking at. And that's really important. So it's about finding ways of subtly hinting to people what's going on. because it is really hard. I mean, visual literacy is low. And there's a lot of really crap charting out there because people still aren't very good at putting these things together and identifying what's gone wrong. There was another one I was going to show that JP Morgan put together. I mean, their analysts should know what they're doing, but they had visualized the change in bank market capitalization from just before the crash to after the crash, and they'd done it as circles, and like one circle for what it was before and one circle for what it was after. But rather than doing it by changing the area of the circle, they changed the diameter, and so catastrophically overestimated the impact of this, and so it made it look like Citibank was now a thousandth of its previous size, and it's things like that are still really, really common.
So where do you learn this? Are there any good books that people can look at? Are there any online tutorials that you would think people should go to?
So there was a few more slides I didn't get to show. I was talking about Edward Tufte.
Yeah.
So his books are probably still the seminal reference, but they're very print focused. And the interactivity is something that isn't addressed particularly well. There's a new book called The Functional Art by Alberto Cairo. That's probably the best, most sort of intellectually coherent book I've seen in terms of analyzing how to produce interactive graphics well. That's absolutely fantastic. Beyond that, I think it's playing and just looking at what's out there. And I mean, I think because of our market and because of the problems we face, I think newspapers are kind of at the cutting edge of a lot of this. So I think between sort of like us, the New York Times, La Nación in Argentina, these papers are kind of probably doing more research in this area than almost anybody else at the moment, simply because of the problems we face.
How about interactivity with video? I mean, we've got this system called Popcorn, and we are talking with journalists.
Popcorn's fantastic, yeah.
So do you do any of that right now, or is it just more of a flash-based thing that people still do?
We don't do much at the moment because we've sort of set a mandate that we will only do things in web standards, but we have to support all these browsers. So, I mean, like, some of the pieces that I showed at the start, actually, they're insane because they'll have all the logic in JavaScript, but they'll have a Flash renderer, a Canvas renderer, and a WebGL renderer. And that's the only way you can actually get cross-browser with all of it. And that's painful enough. Trying to do it with video is even worse. I think, actually, the video is really interesting, particularly in mobile, because there's a lot of interactive formats that don't work well on mobile, but you can produce a simple video that works quite well. And the next step on from that will be starting to add simple interactivity to those videos. Mm-hmm. And obviously, with mobile, we can trust a lot more what browser support there's going to be. So I think things like Popcorn are really, really interesting in that area.
Cool. Are there any questions from the audience? Do we have a microphone to go around? Or just shout it out? Okay, that worked well.
We got one. So,
this is English. Did you do any international work as well? I mean, does The Guardian has a world section as well, and do you see there's differences in visualization in different countries, how they work? Are American visualizations flashier than English ones?
I think you see there's a difference in tone, particularly in South America. If you look at some of the investigative work that's been done in South America in terms of data, I think they take it very, very seriously. I mean, they're dealing with some very serious issues of corruption and the like. But they do really, really cool work, and they tend to do it in a much sort of drier style, I think, because of the meaningfulness of the work. So it's much less playful. Hmm. But other than that, not particularly.
Well, I remember Google had this wonderful visualization API that now has been discontinued.
Yeah.
What were the things that you thought in there were the most useful ones? What do you think is the first, when somebody thinks about it, get a better piece of data, what's the most simple way to show a relationship between the data?
It sort of depends on the shape of the data. I mean, if it's a time series, you throw it into a line chart. If it's sort of a set of variables, then like a scatter plot, essentially. You pick two variables, you pick each sort of set of two variables, and you throw it into a scatter plot, and you start seeing the clusters. And if you're working with data like that, R is an amazing tool. Mm-hmm. Because you can just very quickly knock out sort of histograms, line charts, box plots, and get a real sense of what's going on with the data. And having that as an open source tool, I think, is wonderful. And you can do almost anything out of the box with it now. Mm.
How much do you give back to the projects? Like, you're using them commercially, in mm-hmm. this case. Is there anything that you found in D3 that needed fixing that you sent back to them?
Yeah, we've pushed out various little bug fixes. Nothing big yet. We've actually got a couple of map projections we want to push back to D3. But I think increasingly, as we hit little issues, definitely. I mean, having D3, Mike Bostock's now with the New York Times, so you've got that quite close relationship now between media and the people writing these things as well, which means that feedback loop is a bit faster. Hmm.
Now, in terms of fixed sizes and responsiveness, is there any way to get these things responsive, or I would say Zoom and
yeah,
getting the...
Yeah, you can to a degree. I mean, this one actually does full screen in Firefox and Chrome, which is nice.
Yeah.
And that works. It's just going small beyond desktop is the really hard thing. But you can definitely scale them up.
Yeah.
And things like we've done sort of mapping things where you just sort of reorganize the interface a bit, and that just about works.
One question was, how do they print? And is it really sensible to print any of them?
Well, you can reuse some things. I mean, like you look at like the circles in that map, that's all rendered in SVGs. You can basically just pull that out, put it on top of a normal map, and then that can go straight into Illustrator and out to the printers. And we do that every now and then. But not that regularly, because it tends to be a different version of the same content. So there'll just be nuances about it that mean it's better to do it in a different way for print than it is for desktop. Hmm. I mean, they're fundamentally different mediums, I guess.
So what is as I said before, infographics and visualizations are a big thing. There's actually spammers out there that send you a daily visualization put on your blog for them. And I'm like, why would I ever do that? What is the biggest cliche in visualizations that really grinds your gears?
Bar charts that use things other than bars to do size. So you end up with these weird shapes that then don't do a very good job of explaining the different height of things. That's particularly horrific. The other one is network diagrams with 10,000 points. So we call them hairballs because you end up with these giant plots of just mess.
Hairballs.
And they're still quite common in science, particularly because they're dealing with lots of data. And there is better visualization techniques. So, I mean, if you're dealing with a hairball like that, what you can actually do is use a matrix visualization. So rather than showing all the nodes and relationships between the nodes, you basically just do it as a big table. You put all the nodes on both sides, and if there's a relationship between two nodes, you basically color in that block. And that scales out to any amount of data. It's nowhere near as sexy, it doesn't require 3D to render, but it's very, very functional.
Hmm. Talk about 3D. Do you think it's more confusing or actually telling a story better than a 2D chart would?
It's very rare it's more effective. Like 3D pie charts and things like that are just horrible because they just make it much harder to understand what's there. And then even if you look at like mathematical charting, they tend to use different techniques to avoid having a third dimension. So you get like contour charts, for example, purely to avoid having that 3D effect because it is just such a waste in terms of actually trying to communicate something. Yeah. Every now and then there'll be something, but it's very, very rare.
Are there any tricks that from time to time you have to use in browsers and you think they shouldn't be necessary? I'm thinking, for example, when plotting on canvas, you have to do the half pixel up rendering to the next half pixel rather than just a pixel. Are any things like that as well that are just annoying that could be better?
I don't think it'd be an easy thing to fix. I mean, we use Canvas in situations where there's just too much to render with SVG, but the biggest problem you hit then is you've got to do your hitboxing by hand. And then you've got the overhead of doing all the hitboxing versus the overhead of the SVG node. So it's kind of which is least painful. So that's a big problem. It's probably the biggest problem with Canvas. If there was some way of having hitboxing automatically rather than having to do that by hand, that'd be wonderful.
Okay, we could not ask the audience what hitboxing is, but I'll ask you myself.
So basically, like if you click on a canvas, if you've got like a circle there, to work out whether someone's clicked on that circle, you've got to then know exactly where the circle is on that canvas and know the pixel reference and work out what you've actually clicked on.
Because there's no event model.
So you end up doing things like having a second canvas, which you then colorize based on what the object is, then you can just look up the color reference against a lookup table and techniques like that, but it's quite painful and time consuming to do.
These would be interesting blog posts to do so, to explain. So
yeah, I mean, we'd like to find the time to write out more. It's
Well, I mean, you speak in 20 minutes for other people in an hour, so it's like it should be. But yeah, I think we grilled you long enough. So thank you very much, Alex.